From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program would not be possible without the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. We're very thankful for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Tuesday marks the commemoration of the martyrdom of Sikh Guru Arjan Dev. Sundown Wednesday brings the start of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, and the Catholic feast of the Sacred Heart of Jesus falls on Friday. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
You know, the church has gotten it wrong a few times on science. And I think that we probably are better off leaving science to the scientists and focusing on theology and morality.
That's Republican presidential candidate Rick Santorum speaking out recently on Pope Francis's much-anticipated encyclical on the environment.
When we get involved with political and controversial scientific theories, then I think the church is probably not as forceful and credible. We're better off sticking to the things that are really the core teachings of the church, as opposed to getting involved in every other kind of issue that happens to be popular at the time.
Now, putting aside the fact that the Pope can be considered a scientist, he studied chemistry before entering seminary, climate change skeptics are up in arms about the church crossing some invisible line. But in fact, there's a long history of papal advocacy, and on this week's show, we'll look at some of that history with scholar Kevin Lowe. Also inspired in part by the Pope's leadership on the subject, a rabbinic letter on the climate crisis has been signed by more than 300 Jewish faith leaders. Later this hour, I'll talk with one of the organizers of this effort, Rabbi Arthur Wasko, founder and director of the Shalom Center in Philadelphia. But first,
the Supreme Court is not the supreme branch, and for God's sake, it isn't the supreme being.
And I must act when the jurisdiction of the probate courts is interfered with by one lone judge who has no power or authority to tell them how to interpret the federal Constitution.
There's a case before the Kansas courts, and this new bill Sam Brownback just signed says that unless the courts rule the way he wants them to in that case, he will abolish the Kansas court system.
Later this month, the Supreme Court will issue a ruling on marriage equality that's expected to clarify the conflicting state-level decisions currently convoluting the subject. A new Public Religion Research Institute poll shows a majority of Americans, supporters and opponents alike, expect the justices to recognize marriage as a constitutional right. This widespread expectation has led some on the religious right to threaten defiance to such a ruling. Defiance would be more of a rhetorical exercise if we weren't seeing a very real attempt to do just that, albeit on another issue playing out right now in the state of Kansas. And joining me now is Matthew Menendez, staff attorney at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. Matt, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Start, please, by summarizing the strange turn of events in Kansas that led to the current situation.
Well, the situation started a couple of years ago when Governor Sam Brownback and his allies in the legislature instituted sweeping tax cuts and cuts to public spending. These were challenged in some respects in a lawsuit brought by parents of school children arguing that the cuts to the education system unconstitutionally deprived some students in Kansas of their state constitutional right to an adequate education. The courts had sided with the parents and held that the state needed to equalize and increase education spending. Shortly thereafter, the governor's allies in the legislature passed and the governor signed a bill that stripped the state Supreme Court of some of its authority to administer the state's unified court system. Specifically, the state Supreme Court has long had the authority to select who will be the chief district court judges in the state courts and to set budgetary priorities for the state courts. We represent a state judge who is challenging that law as an infringement on the separation of powers, a suit which is currently pending. And the most recent development is that recently the legislature passed and the governor signed a judicial budget bill, which provides that if the law we are challenging is struck down, the entire judicial budget will be struck. So essentially this law threatens to close the entire state court system for Kansas. This is a remarkable measure. It is, as far as I know, unprecedented in its intrusion on the separation of powers and as an attack on the court system.
What is Brownback's administration trying to do?
You know, I can't speak for them. I can't put myself in their minds. It seems to me that the judiciary is exercising its proper constitutional role. You know, we have a country that is based on checks and balances, where we have three co-equal branches of government, both at the state and federal level. And normally, in the course of things, when a governor or a legislature is unable to get their way because the judiciary has struck down one of their bills as unconstitutional, then, you know, there are adjustments made and different legislation is passed. And in this case, it seems like they are choosing to essentially declare war on a branch of government.
Mm-hmm. So the Brennan Center gets involved. That's significant in itself, given your reputation and the integrity of the Brennan Center. When you talk with people at the center about why you're doing this, what does that conversation like?
Well, we fundamentally talk about the separation of powers. It is mm-hmm. one of the bedrocks of how the United States structures its government. And, you know, the Brennan Center works on many issues. We, you know, we concentrate on voting rights. We concentrate on campaign finance reform, on mass incarceration, on police practices. But one of our areas of focus is on judicial integrity. And, you know, that includes both courts that are fair and impartial and courts that are independent. One of the most important roles the judiciary plays in our society is to protect rights. And there are some things that we have decided to enshrine in our federal constitution and our state constitutions that legislators and governors may not intrude on. Mm-hmm. And the role of courts is to vindicate those rights. So mm-hmm. When there is a threat to the judicial role, we here are always looking to step in and advocate for sound public policy.
Mm-hmm. What's the current status of the lawsuit?
We filed the lawsuit earlier this year. The state has responded to our suit with a motion to dismiss, and we are moving for summary judgment. So briefing will conclude early next month, and then we will await the court's decision after that. And, you know, we are at the trial court level in the state of Kansas, and it would not be a surprise if whichever way the initial decision comes down, the result is appealed potentially to the Kansas Supreme Court.
I see. Am I right that the governor has already threatened the Supreme Court that they better give the ruling that he wants, or he will have this negative action to withdraw money from the judiciary?
Well, that is what the new bill says, and we are currently analyzing that legislation. We think that there are pretty clear grounds for why that bill is also unconstitutional. The Constitution of Kansas requires the court to do a fair number of things, and there are a number of rights that are implicated. And if you were to just close the courts in a state, then you would have any number of constitutional problems.
If, and I'm baffled, to tell you the truth, because listening to you is confirming what I wished that you hadn't confirmed. So what are the long-term implications of this kind of executive overreach?
I hope that at some point soon there will be a measure of sanity restored in the state. I think this kind of action is very destructive to civil society and to our public policy. Mm-hmm. And you know, it demonstrates a lack of respect for our traditions in this country and for the rule of law.
I remember a year or so ago the kind of protest that was coming in congressional districts with various representatives in the House and even the rebuke of some senators. And I remember hearing a person that I respect greatly say, we're becoming an ungovernable nation. You know, that scared me, but isn't this kind of a forerunner for that kind of threat?
I certainly hope not. You know, I'm hoping that ultimately cooler heads will prevail and that we recognize that ultimately, you know, whatever party may be in control at any given time, we have in our country a set of mutually agreed upon rules and structures that ensure an orderly society.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask you, is there any way to apply this gambit to what might happen after a Supreme Court ruling in favor of marriage equality?
Well, it's hard to say. This is a matter that is currently before state courts rather than federal courts. And, you know, in our country, we do have the Supremacy Clause, which says that the U.S. Supreme Court is ultimately the final arbiter of what the Constitution means and how our laws are interpreted. You know, one of the things that could happen is if there were resistance to a ruling at the state level, people would have ready recourse to federal courts, and mm-hmm. states have no authority over the federal judicial budget. And mm-hmm. I don't think that anyone in Congress has proposed anything so drastic as to defund federal courts. So mm-hmm. I am confident that those courts will remain open for, you know, recourse for any rights that may be violated.
So that's very helpful to know. So in Kansas, even if this ridiculous threat were carried out, you simply would start turning to the federal courts for the kind of help that ordinarily you would have gone to the state courts for.
To some extent, that is true. However, there are many rules regarding how you can file a suit in federal court versus state court, and the vast majority of legal actions in our country happen in state court. It's more than 90% of all legal cases do take place in state courts. So mm-hmm. federal courts, both by rule and by capacity, are not going to be able to take on the full burden of stepping in for a state judicial system if it's shut down.
Yeah. We're taping this show today in Louisiana. We have a governor here who has promised that regardless what the Supreme Court does on some of its decisions that will be announced this month, that we're not going to obey that. We're not going to cooperate with that. And it sounds like exactly what's happening in Kansas, but with a different issue. And so I'm really struggling to say, how do we get ready to respond to protect the nature of democracy as we've known it?
Well, I hope that the good people of Louisiana will take notice of what's going on and make clear to their elected officials that regardless of whether one agrees or disagrees with a particular court decision, you have to respect the rule of law. It is the fundamental tenet of our society. And it's very extreme, some of the rhetoric that's been happening.
Yeah.
And, you know, it calls to mind, unfortunately, some of the actions that were taken after the Supreme Court in the 1950s and
Absolutely.
1960s struck down many of the Jim Crow laws and the segregation,
right.
where you see governors standing in the courthouse doors and federal
right.
troops. You know, the National Guard had to be called in. I fervently hope that nothing similar is required, you know, over any of the issues that are happening today.
What do you think is going to happen?
You know, I have faith that ultimately the rule of law will prevail and people will recognize that our judiciary serves a vital role. And, you know, I think it is difficult for some people to accept when a court rules in a way that they disagree with, that is part of our process. And ultimately, you know, we have a tripartite system of government
mm-hmm.
where the legislature writes legislation, the executive enforces legislation, and the courts evaluate the constitutionality of legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard, but I think ultimately cooler heads will prevail and the system will work.
Matthew Menendez is counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. Matt, this is indeed a scary situation. I'm very glad that the Brennan Center is on it, and I'm grateful for the insights that you've shared with us today and for your willingness to be on State of Belief Radio. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate the chance to talk about this very important issue.
With a lot of attention being paid to Pope Francis' imminent encyclical on the environment, it's important to note that faith leaders across the spectrum are calling for action on the climate crisis. With me now is Rabbi Arthur Wasko, who is instrumental in organizing what has become over 300 signatories to a rabbinic letter on the climate crisis. And I am so pleased to welcome him again to State of Belief Radio. Welcome, Arthur.
Thank you. And let me say shalom, salam, pax, peace, and earth.
Thank you. Would you talk about the origins of this letter and how the whole initiative got started?
First of all, there is really profound Jewish tradition rooted in Torah about caring for and with the earth. Mm-hmm. The Torah comes as the spiritual experience of farmers and shepherds, what we would today call an indigenous people. And the most sacred relationship with God was through the sacred relationship with the earth. Mm-hmm. And the Torah is full of ways of honoring, celebrating, and making sacred that relationship. One of the ways is that every seventh year, the Torah says, should be a sabbatical year, a year of release for the earth from having to work for human beings. Mm-hmm. And this year in the Jewish calendar, according to the ancient count, is supposed to be that. So there has been an upsurge of interest in what that means. And there's been a serious discussion been going on for the last couple of years about what this kind of sabbatical year should mean in our lives. Mm-hmm. In ancient Torah, it was about one little sliver of land on the eastern Mediterranean, but now it's the whole planet mm-hmm. that we need to deal with. Mm-hmm. So that's one piece of it. The second piece is, of course, there is a climate crisis. And I think that's why this tradition about the sabbatical year has emerged for a serious discussion, which it really hasn't had for a couple of thousand years. Mm-hmm. And then in late February, we began to hear that folks in the Vatican were saying that Pope Francis was preparing an encyclical. Wasn't clear when it would be issued, but probably sometime in the summer, on the climate crisis. Mm-hmm. And here at the Shalom Center, we began asking ourselves, well, what is a Jewish analog to a papal encyclical, mm-hmm. right? The Jewish community doesn't have a single central authority, but there are the rabbis of all the streams of Judaism, Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, Reconstructionist, Renewal, Humanist, even all those kinds of rabbis. What would it mean if we tried to create a public letter? I'm not sure I've ever seen such a thing, to tell mm-hmm. the truth. Mm-hmm. Trans-denominational letter by rabbis from all the streams about a major public issue. Mm-hmm. So seven of us gathered to work out such a letter, a text we could agree on that we felt was serious and deep, was rooted in Jewish wisdom, going back to Torah, and didn't just talk theology, but also talk practice and activism.
The intention of the letter then going out was educational on the one hand, but also activistic in wanting to get others to join the effort that you care so much about.
Absolutely. Although the letter is grounded in Torah, in Judaism, it certainly speaks to a universal issue. The fact that we were the final step in getting to do this was the inspiration of the Pope's encyclical mm-hmm. is already an indication of how seriously we take the multi-faith teachings mm-hmm. on issues where we can, in fact, learn from each other and learn with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, the Shalom Center and I have been involved in IMAC, Interfaith Moral Action on Climate. We have done both study and conferences and actions together. There have been now several IMAC religious services culminating in religiously rooted street theater about what we call the carbon pharaohs of our generation. The pharaoh both oppressed human beings and brought plagues upon the earth. And that's a definition of what big oil, big coal, and big unnatural gas are doing today. When the BP well in the Gulf of Mexico went bad, the first thing it did was kill 11 of BP's own workers. And then it poisoned a big hunk of the Gulf and damaged the livelihoods of many other folks. So that feels like Pharaoh to us. And we have done, before Passover and Palm Sunday, public religious events that draw on the symbols of matzah, the fierce urgency of now. That's what the matzah was about. There is not time for you to go sitting around baking bread. Just 18 minutes of unleavened bread. Do it and go. And the symbol of the palms with which Jesus led this march of the Jewish demonstrators against the Roman Empire in the local capital of the Roman Empire in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a wonderful passage in Luke which describes that demonstration, what we know as the origins of Palm Sunday. And some of the defenders of the status quo yelled at Jesus that he should make his followers shut. And Jesus answered, if they were to be quiet, the very stones would speak.
Right.
We live in a generation when the very stones are speaking. The frozen stones we call icebergs are shrieking as they melt. The coral reefs are wailing as they die. The mountains of West Virginia are groaning and moaning as they are destroyed for the sake of more oil. The very stones are speaking. We did a demonstration and a religious service in New York City the week before Passover and Palm Sunday this year, and wove into the service an amazing line from the Quran. The line says, God speaking, if you find difficulty happening with the rivers, the oceans, and the mountains, it's not their fault or my fault. It's what you have been doing badly. That's an amazing passage from the Quran.
So, Arthur, when someone comes to you, someone in your congregation, and they say, okay, you've convinced me of this moral challenge that we're facing, what can ordinary people do to contribute to this?
Right. For people to read the whole letter, probably easiest to go to the Shalom Center's website, which is theshalomcenter.org. You got to put that the in there. The Shalom, T-H-E, Shalom, S-H-A-L-O-M, center.org. And on our homepage is the rabbinic letter and a whole list of 340 and some signers. So what we said in the rabbinic letter is one of the ways in which we propose people act. We sort of named Move Our Money, Protect Our Planet. And after we had decided on that rubric, we discovered that the initials of Move Our Money, Protect Our Planet are Mom and Pop. So this is the Mom-Pop movement. And what we said was this, that starting in households and congregations, we can decide where we purchase, for example, electric power from. In Philadelphia, Boston, and a number of other cities, you can actually choose whether to get your household's electric power from coal, burning the planet, or from wind, healing the planet. All you need to do is call your local electrical energy company and ask if you can make that choice. And if in your city you can, then you can actually switch from coal to wind. So that's moving our money. Mm-hmm. That's one level. You can do it in a congregation. I met just a couple of weeks ago with the leaders of one of the major Jewish federations in the United States and asked them where they get their electric power. They looked at each other, and they shook their heads and shrugged their shoulders and said they didn't have the faintest idea. And I said, well, somebody knows, and you should check to find out. And then if you're getting it from coal-fired plants, which not only burn the planet, but give asthma to the neighborhoods. So move it for the sake of social justice and the sake of the planet. Move your money. And by the way, one of the things the letter does is to urge that organizations committed to social justice start working on climate as well, and organizations committed to climate start working on social justice as well. The two are intertwined. They're not separate entities. And in fact, we coined the word eco-social justice to assert that there is no way to separate them. Another level is, where do you bank? And what is the bank doing with your money? Is it investing in big oil and big coal and big unnatural gas? What about our own investments? Some families, some congregations, and for sure most denominations have pension funds or other kinds of investments. Where is that money invested? Mm-hmm. There are now a number of socially responsible investment funds that exclude the carbon pharaohs, exclude them from investments. Well, that's another way to move our money. And a third way is to insist as citizens and voters that Congress and the state governments, many of them, which are subsidizing the most profitable and profit-hungry corporations on the planet, big oil, shift those subsidies to wind and solar energy to heal the planet instead of burning it. That money is crazy that we are subsidizing the burning up of our only home as if we ourselves were putting money into an arsonist instead of putting money into firefighters.
Rabbi Arthur Wasko is the founder and director of the Shalom Center. He's a longtime activist on the environment. He recently organized a coalition of Jewish leaders to sign on to a rabbinic letter on the climate crisis. It's an important step toward organized faith-based action on urgent environmental issues. Arthur, as always, I thank you for sharing your wisdom with us, and I thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for this conversation.
Look, the encyclical isn't even out yet, and already interested parties are pushing back against anticipated instruction from Pope Francis on protecting the environment. Opposition from pundits who are committed to undermining any action on climate change is no surprise. A bit more unexpected is preemptive pushback from overtly Catholic presidential wannabe Rick Santorum and even the Catholic League's shrieky Bill Donahue. There is, in fact, a long, long history of formal papal involvement in global affairs, and an excellent overview of that history appeared recently in Religion Dispatches magazine. The author is scholar Kevin M. Lowe, and I am delighted to have Kevin join us now on State of Belief Radio. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Please start with just a brief description of what an encyclical is and what makes this form of papal direction important.
Well, an encyclical is one of the highest forms of teaching communication that a pope has at his disposal, directed to all of the bishops of the church. The encyclicals in modern times have come to be seen as the most representative form of a particular pope's interests, his particular theological emphases. They're sort of the place that you go first to understand what was really important to a pope. This particular encyclical, which will be released on June 18th, is going to be called Laudatio Si, Praised Be, or Praised Be You. And as you said, it is going to take up the state of the global environment and the responsibility that humans have toward that environment in this era of global climate change. That has been controversial, I think, to the religious right and especially to the Catholic right because of the way that the church has argued for many years that there is a very close relationship between religion and society, between politics and the church, and that these things can't really be separated the way we often like to act as if they can be.
Kevin, were you surprised to see presumably Catholic voices raised in opposition to what the Pope's anticipated saying?
I did find it a little surprising, and that's part of why I wrote the piece for Religion Dispatches. As a historian, my concern is that people are aware of their own history, and for people like Santorum or Bill Donahue to go on record stating that the Pope shouldn't be talking about these issues, that the environment is purely a political issue or a social issue or maybe a scientific issue, but certainly not a moral issue or a religious issue, I think displays a lack of awareness of the social doctrine of the church, this collection of teachings in which the church has stated on numerous occasions that there is this very close, intimate relationship between the church and the world. And I think it's important that Catholics know that history.
Yeah. Did any of the rhetoric stand out as just extremely baffling to you?
Well, I did see that Bill Donahue said something about how God never specifically said that air pollution was a bad thing, and so we shouldn't necessarily work too hard to combat it, which I think is fundamentally opposed to the whole doctrine of creation and stewardship that we see in the Genesis story. But it's also in contradiction to things that even the American bishops, who are often very involved in the culture wars, have been saying for decades, that we have to accept the conclusions that scientists have drawn on climate change, that there is absolutely scientific consensus on these issues. And the church's role in that case is to move forward and talk about what do we do now? What is our moral responsibility? What is our responsibility as Christians, as members of the church? What should we do about this?
Mm-hmm.
Not to continue to argue about whether climate change is happening in the first place.
What level of authority do Catholics see in a papal encyclical? In other words, is this an ex cathedra statement which seems to have more authority than some other statements? Or what is the level of authority that Catholics recognize here?
The level of authority behind any particular encyclical varies. It's a little bit ambiguous,
mm-hmm.
and this often leads to arguments and controversies over just how much individual Catholics ought to listen to a particular encyclical. It really comes down to the type of language that a pope uses in a particular case. For instance, the encyclical Humanae Vitae in 1968 from Pope Paul VI, the so-called birth control encyclical,
mm-hmm.
Stated very clearly that there was to be a continuation of the absolute prohibition on artificial birth control. The specific language that the Pope used in that case has led a lot of commentators and critics to argue that that is, in fact, and at least quasi ex cathedra teaching. It's not officially an ex cathedra teaching, but there's, even in that case, a lot of disagreement and a lot of dissent.
Mm-hmm.
The Vatican itself has been very reluctant to issue a list of doctrines and dogmas that absolutely must be considered infallible.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it leads to a lot of confusion when people try to figure out exactly how much authority to give any particular communication. In general, though, encyclicals tend to be seen as quite authoritative. They tend mm-hmm. to be, again, reflective of a particular pope's very closely held opinions, even though these are documents that are written by committee. They certainly tend to represent issues that are very important to a pope at a particular moment in time. And so I think the general consensus is that Catholics, at the very least, have a responsibility to be familiar with what the encyclicals say and educate their consciences in what the pope is saying at that particular moment. Then there will always be dissent, responsible or irresponsible. But in general, encyclicals tend to carry a fair amount of weight.
Yeah. As a historian, you know how to put this in context and to see the backdrop behind it. I wish you'd talk for a moment about the history of Vatican activism that, like you described in your article.
Yeah, for approximately the last 125 years, the Vatican has been collecting and adding to a body of doctrine that is generally called the social doctrine of the Church, the social teaching of the Church. It's been formulated, again, over this period of time by a number of different popes and individual national conferences of bishops adding to it. There's sort of this loose collection of doctrine which tries to address what the ideal society should look like. And this social doctrine, which touches on everything from the rights of workers to form unions and associations, to the necessity of working for an end of war, to the dignity of all human beings, to the universal destination of goods, the phrase that they use to talk about global inequality and the necessity of bringing people out of poverty. For the last 125 years, the Vatican has been repeatedly wading into politics because of this sense, and it's the sort of fundamental premise behind the social teaching, that what happens in society and what happens in politics, what happens in the economy, is absolutely a moral issue. It's absolutely an ethical issue, and it's a spiritual issue. The social teachings of the Church were collected in 2004 into a single document that you can easily find online or in a bookstore called The Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Church. And one of the fundamental premises in the compendium, which is laid out right at the beginning, the Vatican says salvation permeates the world in the economy, in work, in technology, and so on and so forth, trying to demonstrate that we can't just ignore what goes on in politics. We can't just leave it to some hypothetical, autonomous social realm where the Church has no influence and Christians have nothing to say. The Church has been stepping into these issues and trying to show that, in fact, there is a very strong moral responsibility, that there is a religious aspect to all of these social and political questions. This collection of doctrine has been called the Church's best-kept secret by a number of commentators because the hierarchy doesn't necessarily do a great job of calling attention to it, but these teachings are out there.
At what point does challenging Pope Francis cross a line into something that could be considered heresy?
Well, it's a good question, and I think that that question would have a lot of different answers. I mean, I think you could ask a lot of Catholics that question and get a lot of different responses. I think that there is a risk in treating the Pope as someone to be listened to, again, when it's convenient, and to be ignored when it's not convenient by people who are involved very closely in politics. And I think that that is definitely a danger for the Church.
Kevin, are there instances that you as a historian can think of where global affairs were impacted by directives from the Vatican?
Well, one thing that comes to mind immediately is the length that the Vatican went during the run-up to World War II to the extent of even smuggling in to Germany an encyclical in 1937 that could be read from the pulpits in mm-hmm. Germany. It couldn't be published because of Nazi control.
Right.
And similar things happened during the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. statements coming from the Vatican, and I think the birth control encyclical of 1968 is probably the encyclical that has gotten the most public attention.
Mm-hmm.
It also was hotly anticipated before it was published.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we've seen the level of interest in an encyclical before it was published since 1968, as again we are today.
Mm-hmm. What else should we keep in mind as we wait for the encyclical to come out?
Well, one of the things that I think will be really interesting about the documents is to see how much Pope Francis will refer back to St. Francis of Assisi.
Hmm.
Even the title of the encyclical, Laudatio Si, is taken from St. Francis of Assisi's Canticle of the Son, in which St. Francis talks about brother sun, mm-hmm. sister moon, sister mother earth,
mm-hmm.
And expresses a very familial sense of connection with the earth itself. And I think for Pope Francis to borrow St. Francis of Assisi's language for the very title of the encyclical mm-hmm. means that in the very first sentence of the encyclical, he's at the very least going to be making an allusion to Francis of Assisi, if not making an outright quotation from mm-hmm. his work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be interested to see whether that sense of family comes out in this document that I think will also be challenging for a lot of readers, both within and outside of the church.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's something that would also be in keeping with Pope Francis's ministry thus far.
We'll look for that. Dr. Kevin M. Lowe is an independent scholar of American religious history. Kevin's insightful article for Religion Dispatches magazine is titled "Protesting the Pope's Not Yet Released Environmental Encyclical, Check Your Doctrine." And we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Kevin, this has really been most helpful. I appreciate you sharing your time with us and being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, before we go, you know, there's a perception out there that the issue of LGBT rights is all but solved. Surveys show most Americans expect the Supreme Court to rule in favor of marriage equality later this month. And the most common pose struck by far-right extremists is that of victim. Gay rights are marching forward, they claim, brazenly bolstered by liberal forces up to and including the President of the United States. But this pose gives cover to countless efforts to institutionalize oppression of the LGBT persons. And it's simply impossible to reconcile those efforts with the language of morality that invariably accompanies them. Just this week, in North Carolina, the GOP-dominated state legislature overrode a Republican governor's veto to give magistrates the right to refuse to perform same-sex weddings. The stated purpose is, of course, to protect sincerely held religious beliefs. But it's tough to see that as the actual purpose. Because you can be sure these same magistrates are under a whole lot of pressure right now to develop just those exact beliefs from anti-marriage activists. Meanwhile, in Michigan, a party line vote in the state house led to the passage of three anti-gay, anti-adoption bills. And LGBT prospective parents are not the only targets of this legislation. In fact, the religious conscience language allows adoption agencies to make choices about who gets to adopt based on the agency's religious beliefs. So maybe atheist couples aren't worthy. Or interfaith couples. Who knows? Consciences can be tricky things. It's worth noting that these bills got plenty of support from the anti-gay activists, even though Michigan, along with Louisiana and Mississippi, already have restrictions on same-sex couples adopting children. And then there's Caitlyn Jenner. It's actually been remarkable that a lot of public voices have expressed support and encouragement for the former Olympic hero. but others have made sure to frame the news of such a public moment in transgender history to unleash every insult imaginable, making sure to couch it in the language of faith. The most extreme that I've seen? The Arizona congregation meekly murmuring amen as their pastor rails that his prayer is for God to, quote, rip Jenner's heart out. Meanwhile, watching the news from the first gay rights parade held in Kiev, Ukraine, last month underscored just how far we still have to go to recognize our LGBT sisters and brothers as equally valuable and respected human beings. With more police than marchers present, protesters, many claiming moral outrage, nonetheless disrupted the event and sent numerous police officers to the hospital. Particularly vile was the use of firecrackers modified with metal shrapnel that severed one officer's carotid artery. But when you relentlessly present one particular group that you oppose as absolute evil, what did you expect? And so that officer's life-threatening injury belongs at the foot of leaders, including religious leaders, who treat human lives as disposable in the pursuit of their own agendas. And whether that results in discrimination, violence, or even death, it is always, always wrong. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, and I know some of you did, I want to say a very sincere thank you. The ongoing financial support of our listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. If you find value in what you're hearing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast, and you can find links mentioned during the show. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and I hope you share the stories you find compelling with your friends. We really need you to help spread the word. It broadens the conversation. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. You need to be a member of that organization. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.